Welcome to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age, the show designed to help make middle age your prime time of life by defying the notion that once you reach 40, 50, or even 60 years old, your crowning achievements are all behind you. Regardless of whether you're just approaching 40 or are firmly entrenched in your middle years, it's time to launch your very own personal journey toward a joyful and purpose-filled second half of life. Each week, host Roy Richards, an expert on midlife renewal and author of A Midlife Challenge, Wake Up, will discuss the challenges common to middle age and help guide you to a brighter tomorrow. Now, here's Roy.
Well, I guess we're all here and we survived the Mayan end of the world. And today's program, we're going to talk about the possibility of starting your own business in 2013. Are you itching to make a contribution to society through your idea? Do you have it in me to, or in you to be your own boss? Do you have an idea for a unique new product or for a better way of delivering an existing product? Are you ready for the challenge of setting your own daily agenda? Do you have or can you locate the funding to see you through the startup phase? And 50% of new businesses fail within the first 5 years. Are you prepared mentally to accept that risk? The good news is we have two guests here today who can point you in the right direction. Our guests are William Cobb and Dr. M.L. Johnson, co-authors of the book Business Alchemy, Turning Ideas into Gold. Bill Cobb is the practical guy. He has 30 years as a business executive and a successful entrepreneur, and he's now an author, speaker, and mentor. And Dr. Johnson is a professional educator and research analyst, and he's written 17 books, which is very prolific, so I'm sure he has a lot of very good research for us. That's a great combination of research and practical information. And hello, gentlemen, and welcome to the show. Middle age can be your best age.
It definitely is. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Well, in your book, you ask the question, when you look in the mirror, do you see an entrepreneur? What should I look for to determine if I see one or not?
Well, why don't I start that, and I'll let Dr. Johnson add to it. That's a question that's been asked by people other than us. As a matter of fact, there's an organization out in Kansas City, Missouri, called the Kauffman Foundation, that has probably done more research on entrepreneurism than anyone in America. And they recently published the results of a study done by some folks at Duke University and Akron and a few other colleges that basically asked the question, what is the anatomy of an entrepreneur? And surprisingly enough, you're going to love this given the title of your show, more than 90% of the entrepreneurs came from middle age, pardon me, people who have decided that at some point in their life that they weren't being fulfilled in their careers and that they wanted to do something more interesting and improve their circumstances in life.
When they're in middle age, they've had experience and have seen, probably working for one or more large companies, they've seen how you should do it and how you shouldn't do it, and so that experience, I would think, would be very valuable.
There's no question at all about it. Having a knowledge of an industry or a particular business practice before you go out there on your own is a tremendous advantage. I think the findings, and Dr. Johnson, feel free to chime in, is that these people don't have any special unique talents. They don't come out of the womb as geniuses and entrepreneurs. They're ordinary people who find a way to pursue their dreams and have the tenacity and will to drive that over the goal line.
Yeah, I notice you say you need to be basically intelligent, but you don't have to have genius intelligence to be a successful entrepreneur.
Well, ML did some research on that. Why don't you tell them about the termites, ML?
Yes, there was a turn of the century. We're talking about not the 19 to 20, but the 18 to 19. There was a gentleman, very bright fellow, named Terman, and his dissertation was in regard to super intelligent people. And so he got quite a bit of funding and a teaching position at Stanford. And so his his hypothesis was that the genius people are going to be the ones that are going to lead in every sector. And so he went about primarily in California doing, he had developed a standardized intelligence test, which is paper and pencil kind of stuff. And he probably tested about 40,000 people and came up with about 1,500 and tracked them through their lives. And so he's saying, well, okay, I've identified these people. We're going to show the world that superintelligence is the key to leadership in every sector. Well, unfortunately, that didn't happen. And a couple of people, Luis Alvarez and Shockley, William Shockley, didn't make the grade, didn't reach over the 140 mark for intelligence by his test. And both of them got Nobel Prizes. Alvarez was there at Cal, and his was in physics. And I suppose that Shockley's was also. Shockley was the gentleman that basically invented the mechanism that enabled Silicon Valley.
You know, so one thing for sure. Super intelligence isn't present in Washington these days.
No, they have a different agenda, whatever that might be.
What are some of the key qualities you need to be a successful entrepreneur? You know, other than basic intelligence, obviously, you have to have some smarts. But
well, I think the way the numbers came out is simply that you do have to have a fundamental understanding of business economics. And one of the things we find in our mentoring role, our supporting role here in Northern Colorado, is a lot of the folks that come out of the scientific community or engineering community have never had any exposure to finance and accounting.
Oh, yeah.
And as a result of that, they're very limited in understanding how the economics of a business operates and how the money moves through the company they're considering. So certainly there's a set of fundamentals that have to be acquired. The second thing that we've learned is that these folks are opportunists, and by that I mean simply that they look at a current situation, the changes in our socioeconomic structure or our economy, and where you and I may see disruption and inconvenience, they see opportunity.
Yeah.
And they say, you know, that's changing now, so maybe I can do something different about that and find a way to make it a better place or make it a better situation. And then finally, the one thing I think that ML and I admire the most about them is these folks don't let temporary setbacks get in their way. They're the most positive people in the world. They, you know, they get knocked down, they just get back up and, you know, find another route. And because of that, you know, they're able to create very positive environments that overcome incredible odds and create very innovative products.
They start with a vision in their mind, but they also have to be willing to learn, because I've dealt with potential entrepreneurs before. In fact, I even arranged some people from Grand Rapids, Michigan, who were interested in financing an operation down to an operation in Kansas City that seemed to have a very unique idea for water treatment. I don't know, it was years ago. And, you know, I took them down there, and these people in Kansas City seemed to know it all, and they wouldn't listen to the entrepreneurial or the venture capitalist, and they knew it all, and the whole meeting was a total bust and never went any further.
Well, I'll let the professor comment on that, but one of the things that's obvious for all of us is we don't know what we don't know.
Yeah.
And as a result of it, you're not aware of that ignorant spot or that blind spot.
No, these people definitely did not know what they did not know. It was almost embarrassing.
Yeah, it's actually, we're trying to do something about it, but only about 10% of the patents ever get commercialized.
Huh.
And that's because of a number of reasons, one of which has to do with your ego or their ego. Obviously,
yeah.
Our egos are well in check.
We know everything. We just don't tell everybody that.
Yes, not knowing what you don't know, and then other people that see the broader picture, then after a few minutes, they just pretty much write you off, and that's another patent that didn't get commercialized because nobody can stand to deal with the person that has the patent.
Yeah, and then there's all those ideas that don't even get patented, so there's even a further
absolutely. Stage. Yeah, I'd like to back up just a moment and talk about another characteristic, and that is motivation. These people are motivated, and if you think about, and this is not exclusive, but there is a significant trend toward people who are immigrants being entrepreneurs. They typically don't have a lot of money, and they're motivated to make a place in society for themselves. And there tends to be a larger than not sector of people who are coming from the lower and the middle class, which is to say that perhaps the upper class have already gotten it made, and they're not motivated to try to do something. But another one in regard to age, and we're talking about middle age, and well, I'm liking that. But the middle age is just a number of people, and we can talk about some later, but a number of people in getting ready for retirement had said, well, you know, I want to do something interesting, or I want to do something to contribute to society. But this wonderful quote by George Eliot, and it says, "It is never too late to be what you might have been."
No, that's true. And I always say the worst things in life is to spend your last day asking the question, what if, or if only.
If only, right.
Well, statistics demonstrate that 50% of startups fail within the first 5 years, and then 50% of those survivors fail within the next 5 years, which are pretty long odds. Tell us why so many businesses fail and how your business can avoid that same fate.
That's
like
your expertise, Bill.
Yeah, I was going to say. I know all about failing and not failing, so I'm a typical entrepreneur, I'm afraid. But let me share with you something that we learned, and it's been statistically validated, and that is when you start an enterprise solely on your own, the odds of you not succeeding are dramatically higher than if you start with others. By that I mean have a team of people that begin the enterprise and the new idea along with you. The reason for that is twofold. One is you have expertise around you that you may not personally possess.
Nobody's smart in everything, that's for sure.
Well, none of us are, okay? So, you know, if you don't know anything about finance, it's probably a good idea to have someone who does. If you know nothing about engineering and operations, it's probably a good idea to have someone who does. If you know nothing about marketing, it's probably a good idea to have somebody who does. So you kind of round out the management team when you consider bringing others in alongside of you.
You also motivate each other, too. You know, there's joint motivation when you have two or three others you're working with. You do your part. It's so easy if you're on your own to say, oh, it's a nice day. I'm going to go out for a hike today.
Well, you know, what we tell our young entrepreneurs is even if you could do everything yourself, you're not going to have enough time to do it.
Yeah.
You're just not going to do it. The second advantage to starting that way is at some point in time, most businesses are going to have to raise capital.
Yeah.
You're going to have to learn how to raise money. So you're a much stronger proposition if you come to investors or lenders with a team of people who have a balanced set of expertise to make your enterprise a success. Otherwise, you're going to run into what a lot of young entrepreneurs do. They approach angel investors and venture capitalists, and they find that those financing sources want to put their own management team in your company.
Yeah,
and the reason for that is you don't know what you don't know. You know.
Yeah. Well, you know, you talk about to attract financing, you need a business plan, but even before you do the plan, you should do concept feasibility testing, I believe is the word you use. And what exactly does that term mean, and how do you do that?
That's the mystery part. No, it comes down to, you know, not every idea is necessarily viable in a commercial market, and not every single product is capable of creating a new enterprise. So the first thing you do is determine whether or not someone is actually seeing value in what it is you're trying to create, whatever that product or service is. So you go out and you test that. You test that with friends and family and industry associates that you may know and say, if I build a pencil that sharpens itself automatically, is that something that you would be interested in, and would you buy it, and what would you buy it for?
And you try and determine
whether or not there's actually a market, transactions available for that product.
We're talking about business plan. I think we need to interject that particularly people with patents think that the patent is the deal in terms of commercialization. Actually, patents only about 10% of the value, and the other 90% is your business plan. You know, does it look like that this group of people can actually take the patent and make it happen? So that's a myth that people think. Well, I've got the patent. You know, that's going to be the springboard that's going to make me a billionaire, and it may be. But when you're talking to investors, they're more savvy, and they say, Do you really have a group of people here and organized in a way that called a business that could make this thing fly?
The other second half of your question, Roy, was simply, you know, why do they fail later on? And very few companies can survive on one product.
Yeah.
So even if you have a good idea, you know, when it gets you into a market and gets you started, complacency will not enable you to sustain your business in today's world. You know, we're all smart people, but the reality is there's lots and lots of smart people out there. And if you can see an opportunity, it's highly probable that somebody else sees it too.
Yeah, that's
so,
the rub.
You know, you've got to, once you get on that treadmill, you know, if you're an innovative company like Apple, you know, I always tease my younger family members here that, you know, which Apple version do you have this week? Because, you know, that company seems to come up with a new idea every 2 weeks or so. But that enables them to take a leadership position and sustain their organization. And whatever it is that you decide to provide, count on having to improve it, have it to modify it, having to add to it, having to look at different ways to take it to market, start looking at different markets, ways to expand. Unfortunately, commerce is a lot like nature. If you're not growing, you're in trouble.
Bill's talking about time and effort in the project, and a bit of paranoia is it might be healthy. And for example, in the basketball sector, most of us remember Pete Maravich, and as a youth, he was just driven to practice because he was thinking some other kid out there is practicing harder than me. And he's going to get the scholarship, and I'm not. So working, you know, looking, well, there's got to be somebody looking over my shoulder or doing the same thing. You know, you had two different people that invented Leibniz and Newton, both invented calculus. They, however, were about 10 years apart, and Newton was a little ahead but in terms of time. But there's other people out there working, looking at the same situation and usually problems and figuring out a way to do it. So moving on quickly is a way to get to the market before they do.
Yeah, that concept feasibility testing is so important. I know I've had a couple of failed ventures in the past where we sat around time after time revising these rosy business plans, you know, that showed such and such sales in each year, and we played around with these numbers, but we really hadn't done the feasibility testing to see if anyone would really buy the service that we were intending to provide. And when we went to venture capitalists, they said, well, who is your name? And none of us, three of us, really had a quote name. And the second question was, you know, have you tested this project to make sure that it works and that somebody wants to pay for it? And that wasn't a very good answer we gave to that either.
Well, we find I do a lot of volunteer work here in our community with our young companies. We have what they call an incubator, a group where they all kind of gather, and we do our best to keep them moving forward. But There's three things that all young companies underestimate. One is the one you just mentioned, and that's the amount of work that it takes to develop a realistic market plan. You could have the greatest widget in the world, but if nobody knows about it, it doesn't matter. How are you going to get it out there and how are people going to buy it? The second thing they underestimate is the skill requirements, the management team necessary to enable you to develop and grow that enterprise, commercialize your product. And then the third thing they're all terrible at is financial planning. They're horrible at it. And, you know, my favorite Gordon Moore quote, everybody knows about the exponential growth of the transition, but his second famous quote is that everything takes longer and costs more than you think it does.
Yeah.
But money always runs out on time. And it does.
the product or business idea, sometimes you have to be real creative about how you do the feasibility. I'm thinking of a product that 3M made, and the product actually came from a failure because they make sticky stuff, tapes and such. And so they had developed this one concept or this one product that was supposed to be a good sticky deal, and it was only partially sticky. And so it sat there for a while, and then somebody says, well, you know, what if we put this on a piece of paper because it doesn't stick very, very long, and then cut them up into little packets, and they still couldn't get anybody to bite on it. Finally, they went to Boise, Idaho.
Oh.
And just started giving out these little packets of sticky things. We call them now sticky notes. And and then showing people what they were and then asking them, well, okay, now this is what it is. You're looking at it, you know, and would you buy something like this? And that's how they did the feasibility and the launch on that sucker.
I'll be darned. I'm holding a package of Post-it notes in my hand.
You got the Post-it notes right there.
Yeah, it's a nine-figure business for them. It turned out okay.
Yeah, just consider that was a failure, absolute failure for 10 years.
There's a million stories like that out there. You know, my favorite one is the hula hoop, where some company overbought in plastic tubing and didn't know what to do with it. And, you know, next thing you know, they made hula hoops out of it.
Yeah, you know, remember the kids.
Life goes on.
I never could get those to hold up very well. Well,
yeah,
that
pet rock I never bought either.
We're talking here mostly to small one-person type things and not large corporate leaders and stuff. But if you can't arrange venture financing, you know, a whole lot of it anyway, how about some popular shoestring budget options like internet businesses or network marketing? Do you have any ideas on what's like a good approach for something on a shoestring if you don't have
we
a lot of money?
We actually have the hottest thing that has been invented in a long time for raising capital for these small operations.
Oh.
And the rules and regs from the SEC now are being promulgated, and it's going to be hitting pretty quick. So actually, they've already hit. And so Bill's going to tell you about that. Called crowdfunding.
Well, let's look at the whole spectrum here. I think it's fair to recognize that there are basically three kinds of ventures that are started out there in the marketplace.
Yeah.
One is what we affectionately call the lifestyle business, and this is the small business that you're referring to.
Yeah.
Normally, these are people who want an enterprise to be their own boss, make a living from it, but are not necessarily looking to build something they're going to sell and get rich from.
Yeah.
There's a second group of people that are what I call build-to-sell entrepreneurs. These are the serial entrepreneurs. They like to build a company, get it to a certain level, sell it to someone else, and many of them go back and do it again. And
that's
then the third one is the one you read about in the Wall Street Journal, the big legacy company that, you know, one in a million that goes public and makes somebody $1 billion.
Yeah.
But for the smaller ventures, the what I call the lifestyle companies, first and foremost, the service companies require very little capital to get started.
Yes, that's true.
Because your primary product is you. It's what you're able to build. So I always tease ML. I started the consulting business with a laptop and a printer. That was my total investment, right? I have a good friend of mine who built a landscaping business, started with a lawnmower and a trimmer. So, you know, they bootstrapped it from scratch, and they were able to do that. The second kind of businesses that are easy to bootstrap in today's world are internet-based businesses.
Boy, the
internet gives you access to 4 billion people.
Yeah.
I mean, just think about that for a moment, how phenomenal that is. So if you can be a content provider, create content of value, you now have an immense global market that you can offer that to.
Yeah,
and, you know, what's in vogue right now are people are writing for blogs, you know, doing that kind of thing. They're basically brokering on the internet, the eBay model, where you know, you buy it from somebody and then broker it out onto somebody else. But these are things that you can manage from your home office for basically for the cost of an internet connection and some arrangement with a merchant bank like PayPal or someone so that you can get paid electronically.
Yeah, so, there's a lot of stuff out there.
It's amazing. So, you know, in terms of being able to look at ways to get into your own enterprise without having to invest tremendous amounts of money, there are many options available to you. In terms now of companies that require a storefront or require inventory, something to sell that's tangible, you're going to need money. You know, many of the ways you can do that is talk with the Small Business Administration. In spite of what you hear, they're actually very, very good. They can help you with, you know, government-guaranteed loans to enable you to get started in that regard. Friends and family are always good because they're willing to invest in you, not necessarily your business, but you, and they're not as discriminating in terms of what they do from a due diligence point of view. But, you know, the average business today in America takes, according to the SBA, about $175,000 to get started.
Wow. Yeah, that's why the Internet may be a good idea.
Yeah, Internet's much better. It costs about, you know, $45 a month. But, you know, that's what it takes to get a small business storefront up and running.
Yeah,
and then, of course, you know, we have the other option that ML was talking about. If you need more money because you're going to develop an actual product and you're going to have to do some research and build a prototype before you can get it to a commercial stage, you're going to have to look probably to investment capital, and that means diluting your ownership to either a small group of investors like angel investors who will come in and give you X number of dollars, sit on your board and participate in helping you get your company started. And then we have this new vehicle, which has just been passed by the legislation, called crowd financing. And basically what crowd financing is, it's very similar to a private placement memorandum that is now able to be sold to other than accredited investors. Used to be you have to go find people that had $1 million or more before you could sell them a piece of your company. Under the new legislation, it allows everyday people, folks like you and I, to buy a smaller portion of a new venture, and it enables the entrepreneur to sell more of those shares to a broader audience of folks to raise the money that they need.
How would a potential entrepreneur access that? It sounds great.
Well, the legislation is brand new. The rules have not yet been defined. The Securities and Exchange Commission is supposed to bring them down by the middle of December. They're going to come down probably under what they call Regulation D, somewhere in there. But the thing that I think all of our young entrepreneurs and business people need to recognize, and this is my soapbox, I apologize for it, is that when you operate with other people's money, you have a fiduciary responsibility to use that money for the purpose by which you acquired it.
Yes,
and,
that's
you know,
very
you, you have
true.
To report on what you do with that money. You have to provide visibility into how that money is being invested to promote and grow the business. And, you know, that's a discipline that very many single entrepreneurs had difficulty with.
And that's also a discipline they must master if they're ever going to succeed in business anyway. So,
it's not a bad idea, even if it's just your company, to make out a quarterly report for yourself so that you know what's going on and what you're doing.
But there
are lots of ways to get started, and we encourage everyone, you know, to look at things objectively. Pardon me, you know, pick the business that you could afford to be in.
Yeah.
And that's where you start. It's not necessarily where you finish. And, you know, grow it, build some profits, operating cash flow, and then, you know, pick your head up and look around, see what you want to do next.
Yeah,
there's
I think it's another aspect of
equity that particularly investors will want to know how much is involved, and that's your own sweat equity. And that should be documented. I mean, they may not say, well, we're going to give you $500,000 because you worked really hard, but they will want to know how much skin do you have in the game.
Yeah, what are the results and what skin do you have in the game?
Well, you can't blame them.
No, I certainly don't. I once knew a guy that collected about $250,000 and spent about a year doing absolutely nothing except paying himself a $5,000 monthly stipend.
I'll bet his investors loved that.
Yeah, they sure did. They all went looking for him, then he declared bankruptcy and disappeared into the night.
But we don't want that.
Please, you say that the U.S. needs more entrepreneurs and less CEOs. Please explain that distinction and how we can develop and encourage this entrepreneurial behavior. I guess you've given some ways we can do that.
I am dangerous on statistics here, and I'll share a couple with you. One of the disappointments of our current economic situation is that we are currently creating less new businesses than we have since they started keeping score on these things in 1994. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, we created less businesses in recent years than we ever created in our history. The result of that is that the new jobs that come from these new companies are also not being created.
Yeah.
And the delta, at least the statisticians tell us, we're down about 2 million jobs as a result of the creation of a lack of creation of new ventures. So there's not only new ventures being created, but the employment implications of that are pretty dramatic as well. The second reason I say that, you know, we need less CEOs is there's a recent report published in the Wall Street Journal called the CFO Report. And what they do is they survey all the top CFOs of the big major corporations. The top 1,100 rated companies by Moody, the credit rating company, are currently sitting on an insane amount of cash. How much do you think they're hoarding right now? Just take a guess. 1,100 companies, global companies, they're sitting on almost $2 trillion worth of cash.
Well,
$2 trillion.
Give that to
money
the government to pay down the debt.
Well, I don't know what they're doing with it, but, you know, they're certainly not reinvesting it in creating new products, new services, and new opportunities for people. So if those companies are not going to do that for whatever their reasons are, then for them to have those new products, those new services, they're going to have to acquire companies that do innovate and develop them.
Yeah.
And that's where the entrepreneur comes in. The entrepreneur can make such a tremendous difference on our economic fabric in the creation of new companies, new jobs, and then creating products and services of value that can be integrated into some of the larger established institutions. So we're very strong advocates of the process and very strong believers that our future economic growth is going to come from this group.
Yeah, I like the term you have in your book of intrapreneurism, where companies look to start new businesses within existing businesses, which sounds like a great idea and you know, a whole separate subject. But how, if you're working for a company, you interest your boss in doing something new and entrepreneurial, perhaps where you work right now. I think that'd be a great thing to look at during the new year as well.
And as you speak, it's not that complicated. People are working, doing jobs that may or may not be the most effective, and so you really look to see how can I make this cheaper, how can I make it better, how can we do it faster, how can we address a real need out there in the both in the workplace and in society. So if you look to try to find solutions to problems, then you're well on your way, being open to those opportunities.
Yeah, I think that was one of our most fascinating learnings from writing the book, was that the definition of quote unquote entrepreneurism is much, much broader than we ever thought.
Yeah.
You know, people who develop new models for automobiles, they're entrepreneurs. People who develop new products for Apple, I mean, they're entrepreneurs. There's more of that going on inside existing institutions than you may realize. Yeah. And the same is true for nonprofits, right, ML?
Right. Roy, I don't know if you have Googled hippo water roller. It's phenomena that's going on in Africa. And these two fellows were working during apartheid as munitions experts. Then after that fell, they had, I think, probably a little bit of guilt that they had to deal with. And so they looked around and said, you know, what really sucks in Africa that we can do something about? And so they looked to see how far people were having to carry water over their heads with the implications of that for the spinal injury for the women and children that were doing it. And so they invented a device called a hippo water roller. Hippo, I think, because it's just big.
Yeah.
And instead of carrying water, people roll it. It is fascinating concept. And it's a nonprofit, as Bill says, but it's entrepreneurism. And it is catching fire going across Africa. Cargill, big conglomerate, has bought into it. And they're saying, hey, not only we can help these people carry their water, but if we're going to sell seed to them, we put the seed into the barrel first and roll it out there, and then they empty the seed out and then use the barrel for rolling water.
So,
great. All kinds of opportunities out there if we just look to see how can we fix something that could be better for society.
Tell people how they can obtain your book, Business Alchemy, Turning Ideas into Gold. I know you say the book's a word map to guide you through the process, and that's what I'm sure a lot of budding entrepreneurs would like to get a hold of. How can they get your book?
Well, it's available at all the online retailers, Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com and several others. So certainly you can Google it and find it on the Internet. But you can also get it through your local bookstore. If you're like us and you'd like to support the local folks, most of them have access to the publisher, and if they don't have it on the bookshelf, they'll be able to get it for you.
Well, I know you also have a website, www.bizalchemy.com. That's BIZALCHEMY.com, because I visited that yesterday. And
well, you can go there and learn more about the book. You can take a look inside the book, as they say. But equally important is there's a way for those who are interested in learning more to contact either Dr. Johnson and myself, ask us a question or two, challenge us, and if we don't know the answer, we'll do the best we can to find it for you and get back to you with the information you're looking for.
Yeah, well, that's certainly a wonderful offer, and thank you so much, gentlemen, for being with us today. I think it's been a very valuable lesson to anyone that's considering going beyond just having a good idea and getting that into practice during the new year. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's good to meet you, Roy.
It's been our pleasure.
Well, after listening to our two guests, are you ready to draw a line in the sand? 2013 is the year I'm going to quit my present job and become my own boss. Let's also assume that you have a concept for your new business firmly in mind, be it an innovative new product or service, purchase of an existing business, or simply what our guests called a lifestyle business, selling your time and talent to provide a service, perhaps on the Internet. Before you take the plunge and quit your day job, here are a few suggestions from my book, A Midlife Challenge Wake Up. First, have you completed a workable family transition budget in order to pay the bills? Remember, as our guests pointed out, it almost always takes longer and costs more than you think it will. Are your spouse and children on board, and are they willing to share in the sacrifice? Believe me, it's almost impossible to start up a business if you've got negative input daily from your family members. How will you obtain the technical, financial, and occupational skills needed to launch? Don't overestimate what you know, and as the guests point out, be willing to know what you don't know. Can you do it alone? Can you sell your concept and recruit a team? Is this what you want to do? And this is a less of an issue, obviously, if you're going to do a lifestyle business, perhaps, than if you're going to start a whole new business from scratch. Can you test your concept at night or on weekends while you retain your present job? Obviously, that's an ideal situation, so long as there's no conflict of interest and so long as you're not slighting your present employer. Obviously, he deserves a full day's effort for a full day's pay. How will you demonstrate necessary qualifications to potential business partners, lenders, and investors? And again, this is less of an issue if you're talking about a shoestring lifestyle business on the internet or something like that, maybe multi-level marketing. Are you ready to be your own boss, set your own agenda, avoid distractions, deal with disappointments, which are inevitable, and keep the ball rolling forward? Remember, you're going to have a detailed work plan, and you're going to have interim objectives, something to keep your feet to the fire, because it's easy to get distracted. Recognize that at least half of all new businesses fail, so it's really essential that you have a backup plan in mind before you venture out on your own. Use what you have learned from the first failure and then move on. The worst possible result, obviously, is to go for it now, fail, and then sit paralyzed by fear and recognize yourself as a failure, stuck in neutral, and unwilling to try anything new. So that's why it's so essential that you have a backup plan. In my book, I offer extensive advice on mid-career transition, including prospects for starting your own business or for finding that one-in-a-million job that will make you happy for the rest of your working career. Never forget, middle age is the best time to start your own business. You can take advantage of the skills and knowledge you've learned as an adult and apply it, and you've also learned maturity, and you can become, it's the best time to become your own boss. Never forget, it is possible to have a good time while earning a living. My book, A Midlife Challenge Wake Up, is available through Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, or through our website, www.middleagerenewal.com, and it's available both in print or in ebook form. And let me take this opportunity to wish you and yours a most happy and prosperous new year. Let's make 2013 the year of renewal for every middle-aged person. Thank you very much, and good luck.
You've been listening to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age, hosted by Roy Richards, an expert on midlife renewal and author of both A Midlife Challenge, Wake Up, and Wake Up, Captain and Crew, Restart Your Engines. You can learn more about Roy and his Middle Age Renewal Training System by visiting his website, middleagerenewal.com.